As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Destination Germany. It's a urology special with some teams finding it hard to go and France taking the pee from Gibraltar. We round out the big stories and ask, will Wales be Thanksgiving with Turkey this week? Plus, there's the week's other big news, the Premier League getting tough on the Toffees with that 10-point penalty. We'll look at that and hear about Qatar 1 year on and more in this Totally Football Show. Monday 20th of November, listener, welcome to your very own Totally Football Show. Today with Charlie Eccleshare.
Hello.
Here in the studio and on our big screen, Daniel Storey.
Yes, staring over you like a benevolent Sauron's eye.
Yeah, if Sauron was wearing an accidental goatee.
Yeah, I had an electric shaver fail this morning.
Oh, we've all been there.
I'm sure there's YouTube compilations of the same.
Yeah, yeah. When you go over the whole head like I do, actually, I was going to say you could end up with 50-50, but I'm kidding myself. There's no way I could get 50-50 or anything. Yeah. Exciting. You've had a busy few days. We'll be hearing about that, Daniel. You've been as far afield as the other side of the Trent and also Sweden. I should mention that among the many big bits of news of the last few days, the Everton point penalty, and also Totally Football Show winning the Football Content Awards 2023 for Best Podcast International. I think for the quality of our international football coverage. So Euro 24 qualifiers, probably the last that October break, that nailed it for us.
That's what's good. Yeah, a lot of pressure today to maintain that level.
I'm pretty confident, Charlie.
So am I.
Pretty confident. I know we've been all over all the weekend's matches. And I tell you what, let's begin then with a quick roundup of where we are at in Euro qualifying. Since our last podcast on Thursday, 8 more teams have qualified for next summer in Germany. Welcome to Hungary, Serbia, Slovakia, Albania, Denmark, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Romania. 4 automatic places are still up for grabs, 3 of which are going to be decided on Monday night when the Czech Republic face Moldova. The Czechs just need a point. Moldova, meanwhile, bidding to reach their first ever major tournament. When Slovenia face Kazakhstan. Slovenia just need a point. The Kazakhs also looking to reach their first ever tournament. And Ukraine take on Italy. Missouri have actually been to a major tournament before, kids. And they just need a draw to make this one after they smashed North Macedonia 5-2. On Friday, Ukraine, the hosts, although it's in Leverkusen, must win. And then on Tuesday, Wales' fate will be decided. It's no longer in their own hands after their disappointing 1-1 draw away in Armenia, because Croatia on Saturday won 2-0 in Latvia. So if they win at home to Armenia, they're there no matter what Wales do with Turkey on Tuesday. Wales against Turkey.
Turkey, fresh from a win away at Germany.
Interesting. And under Vincenzo Montella, they've come alive. Did you watch, I mean, maybe the highlights? Kai Havertz scoring a goal.
Yeah. I mean, Kai Havertz playing at left back.
Yeah.
And scoring a goal, popping up in a centre forward position, scoring with his right foot.
Yeah.
as a left back. Very Kai Havertz.
And conceding a penalty with his left hand.
Sure. That's where he goes to.
Did you see any of these goals, Daniel?
No, sir.
All right. If you seek them out, I mean, the first two Turkish goals are pretty special. Aktürkoğlu, who equalised after Kai Havertz opened the scoring, and then Yildiz. Aktürkoğlu, basically a wonderful... When somebody takes the ball down for a long hoof upfield and then just with one foot and then slams it in with the other, and Yildiz is a lovely curling shot. Anyway, they look fabulous, Turkey. We've mentioned them as potential forces in Germany next
summer. Wasn't that a thing at the last Euros that they were everyone's dark horses and then imploded and fell quite spectacularly? Maybe they'll put that to bed
this time. Vincenzo Montella. Anyway, Wales are going to be facing them on Tuesday. And Daniel, you're grimacing already, probably after the position that Wales, after doing all the hard work with Croatia, have now put themselves in.
Yeah, they've taken 1 point from those two Armenia games. It's quite a strange group, that one, with Turkey overperforming, Croatia underperforming, but not by enough that I think they'll probably still qualify. It was a very difficult group for Wales, particularly with the kind of, you know, the changing of the guard with Bale and Ramsey, etc. But yeah, they've just let themselves down in those two games against Armenia, who are no mugs. They're improving, just as seven or eight countries from that side of Europe seem to be doing now. They are improving quickly, but yeah, that's a really poor performance. And I think probably the end of Rob Page as Wales manager.
Right. Okay.
They stuck with him after the World Cup because they wanted to see him to see through this changing of the guard. But the reaction on the weekend on Saturday was really, really, you know, pretty angry from fans who, and I don't think it was over expectation for them to expect to get the job done, having done really well to beat Croatia.
Yeah, indeed. So, all right, we'll see what happens with that on Tuesday. Wales do still have the playoff route. Monday, meanwhile, as I mentioned before, a bunch of other teams seeing if they've already qualified. Italy will be away in Leverkusen against Ukraine. They also still have that playoff route. Not sure how much it's worth us going into what happened with them, given a lot of people will be hearing this after the Ukraine game has happened. But
given that the concerns were about them scoring goals, that's pretty telling, isn't it?
It was a huge 5-2 win for them. I mean, they did have under Mancini a year ago a 4-0 win over Malta, but this felt like a real release. The first real Spallettian performance of this is Yuri Zaidan. I don't think it's coincidence that when Federico Chiesa's back fit and when he's stuck out on the wing with a proper centre forward, and it all comes together really nicely. Barella played really well as well. Di Marco looked fabulous. Yeah, they just looked great.
I mean, he was such a star, obviously, of the last Euros, Chiesa. Mm. It would be a shame if he weren't there this time around.
Certainly would. Oh, also Jorginho trying his penalty again. Much like someone who's got a party trick that was successful back in the 90s and insists on doing it every time there's a get-together.
Yeah, it is amazing how it doesn't seem to faze him. He just keeps
four
getting back
penalties
on the horse
in a row that he's missed now for Italy, doing that.
Is that including the shootout?
Okay, that one didn't matter, but it could have.
Well, it did
at
the time.
The two that he missed against Switzerland, one in the same stadium, actually, at the Stadio Olimpico, in the World Cup qualifying, that effectively cost Italy their place in Qatar. Mm. And then there he was. And as soon as you saw him stepping up with his little hop, you kind of knew. Yeah. And it was a terrible shot. Bizarrely, afterwards, Spalletti was, of course, asked about this. And he said, no, he will be taking our next penalty. I've told him that. And he said, he's going to. And there was
and we'll be doing the exact same thing.
There's been a bit of a reaction. And I think that quietly, privately, that it will be Chiesa or one of the other people who actually scores goals for a living who will be taking care of that if that happens in Leverkusen. Otherwise, very nervous moments should they get awarded a spot kick.
There's that bit in Blackadder, I think, where General Melchett talks about how if we do the same thing we've done every time for the last 20 attempts, that's the last thing they'll be expecting.
Mm.
So that might be a little bit of Jorginho's logic. Surely no one's going to... I'm not going to do this 5 times in a row, am I?
Well, maybe so. Maybe so. Daniel, you watched Romelu Lukaku scoring 4 goals in a half with clinical finishing.
Et Mangala, Lukaku, quatrième! Mais c'est pas vrai!
Il est à l'origine, hein? Il est à l'origine.
Mais c'est pas vrai!
And up to 83 international goals, which is an awful lot at the age of 30. Puts him joint 7th in the history of football, international football.
Really?
Yeah, he's got so 2 more, I think, and he goes into 6th by himself ahead of Ferenc Puskás. And the remarkable thing, I know that the globalisation of kind of qualifying means that there are more games against weaker teams. That's undoubted. But he's scoring goals. He scored his 83 goals in 113 caps. It's a better goal per game ratio than Messi and Ronaldo, who are the two kind of big names above him in terms of international goals.
I mean, Messi famously never performed for Argentina for years and years and years. So maybe that's something.
And has 108, I think. Cristiano Ronaldo has 128 in 205. And yeah, I mean, he scored 11 at major tournaments. He went missing in that World Cup game when he was half fit and missed the first chance and then missed all the others. And that sadly will come to define part of Lukaku's legacy always. But 83 goals and 113 caps by the age of 30 is mad.
It is amazing, but it kind of stands to reason, because I remember Lukaku, when he played in England, the criticism was often that he couldn't do it against the stronger teams. Certainly when he went to United, there was this stat that he didn't score against big six teams for a long time. So given the standard, certainly in these qualifiers, is probably going to be towards that lower end, it would make sense. I mean, he's always been someone who has been very reliable to score a lot of goals. It's just whether he's scoring them necessarily at the right time. And I guess that World Cup example again plays into that.
Yeah, although there was that fitness question there, I guess. What about England beating Malta by 2-0? Charlie, you were mentioning that you saw 20 minutes of highlights this and you're wondering, how did they get 20 minutes? And I'm guessing, was it because they took it until about 4 minutes in and then got the last 16 minutes?
It probably was overwhelmingly weighted towards that period.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I find it very hard to get too wound up about a dead rubber in qualifying that England have cruised through and a lot of countries haven't. How they do in this game ultimately will have so little relevance on how they do next summer. You know, and he was able to give some fringe players minutes. Maybe some would have wanted a more experimental side, but yeah, it's not really how Southgate operates.
All right, you got me pumped for North Macedonia this evening.
The big one. Yeah, I mean, the main intrigue, I think, with that is the pitch that apparently is a little bit dodgy. I believe when Italy played there, Immobile was talking about how dangerous it was.
Mm.
So that will add an edge. I think suddenly some fans who had no interest in this game, suddenly then when they think their club players might be picking up injuries and will just be praying that they don't start.
Mm. Daniel, England.
Yeah, it was a desperately dull match. I think we also have to remember, Southgate was pretty frustrated after the game. He kind of said, I need more from players than that. And I can see why he's annoyed. But ultimately, players are being flogged, are knackered. I think there was a stat, BBC Sport did some analysis, and I think 96% increase in hamstring injuries in the Premier League this season. And I think players, whether it's subconscious or half deliberate, see a game Malta at home and think, I can't really afford to give my all because I've got Premier League, and then next week is Champions League and Europa League again, and then we hit the December rush. And I just think this was one international break game too many. And as Charlie said, it was also a dead rubber, which legitimises their thoughts. If it had been Italy at home and England had lost 3-0, which they would have done if they'd have played like that, then there would have been different questions to answer. As it is, they can afford to go at third pace against Malta and still win reasonably comfortably.
That hamstring analysis that you read, was that the one that suggested that it might be VAR's fault? Because you're getting these kind of three, four, five minute interruptions where players are effectively stocked still.
Well, there was a theory going around when Mickey van der Ven got injured quite soon after the long, long VAR delay in the Spurs-Chelsea game a couple of weeks ago. And Postecoglou was asked about it, and he said, yeah, absolutely, there's a chance that there... You know, he said, I can't draw a direct line between those two things, but of course that could increase the risk.
Yeah.
I mean, I do wonder as well, and this was very much like, you know, school PE, but I was always taught if you do things half-heartedly, you're always more likely to get injured.
Is that right, Charlie?
So I was told. No idea if that stands up to scrutiny now. But
I don't know that that's...
But it makes me nervous if players are sort of subconsciously trying to hold themselves back for these games, whether that might, on some level, make them more vulnerable.
Okay.
But I am really curious, generally, as to whether players do this. I mean, Saka is someone who, you know, takes a load of kicks, and people say that what he does, he does sort of conserve energy for periods of games.
Mm.
He'll sort of just coast along, which is quite an interesting idea. And there are probably quite a lot of players who do that as well. And as Daniel says, it's even more necessary at this time when they're getting so overloaded that you're going to see players doing that.
Yeah. All right. Any lessons from your PE, Daniel? that might be relevant to this?
Not that I want to repeat here.
Okay, all right. I see. All right, well, in terms of European footballing powers taking on British Mediterranean outposts, far more interesting was France's clash with Gibraltar. Finally, someone scores big in the half time and then goes for it in the second half, and we got double figures. Yay!
Oui, oui, oui! Magnifique! Le lob! Le 300e! Oh, quelle magnifique façon de signer son 300e but!
14-0 was the scoreline here. The game influenced, but probably not all that much, by the fact that the third goal involved a foul on the incredible Zaire Emery, which saw Gibraltar go down to 10 men. But I think, you know, they could have had 14 players and it wouldn't have made that much difference against this France. Pick of the goals for you, Daniel?
I mean, I love international football, but some of the defending was absolutely... I mean, it was ludicrous.
Okay.
Their heads absolutely went down after that red card, no doubt.
when they were 13 down, they knew they were beaten.
They were already 3-0 down at that point. As I said, I do sort of agree. I've got a lot of time. I love it when it goes 7 and then they double it and they keep going afterwards. But at the time, it felt quite awkward to watch.
Right.
To see Giroud coming on and scoring in like the 89th and the 92nd.
Doing a bicycle kick for the last goal as
well. Yeah, because he's got goal records to extend. And Mbappe with the double hat-trick, the hat-trick of goals and hat-trick of assists. I mean, the phrase stat padding is generally kind of consigned to Twitter reply guys, but there was a lot of stat padding going on.
Giroud's last goal is amazing, that bicycle.
Yeah.
Also, the fact that the officials only added on 2 minutes, like they were obviously trying to do their bit of mercy, and they still, Giroud found time to score in stoppage time. I also can't think of many players more than Giroud who would just be ravenous to try and score some goals there. Like, he's never been someone to, I don't know, not just want to score whenever he possibly can and kind of do overly exuberant celebrations.
Yeah.
If you're asking for my favourite moment of the match, it is Kylian Mbappe playing all 90 minutes. That's the most ludicrous thing.
Okay. Well, it was the biggest win that France have ever had. It's the biggest win that anyone's ever had in qualifying for a European Championship. And it featured the youngest French goal scorer since 1914 in the shape of Warren Zaïre-Emery. Good goal too. Although I think it was in that defensive action that he picked up that injury, which saw him come off. Les Bleus' record in Group B now reads, played 7, won 7, scored 27 and conceded 1. They've got Greece on Tuesday, which could be interesting. By the way, that wasn't the only 14-goal haul this weekend, because Arsenal under-16s beat Liverpool under-16s 14-3 with, I read, the highly rated Chido Obi-Martin scoring 10 of them.
Yeah, I have to say that scoreline made me sit up and take notice more.
Right.
Because, you know, France beat Gibraltar.
Yeah.
But Arsenal beating Liverpool 14-3, that is, yeah, extraordinary.
Right, and him getting 10 goals.
A 10-goal haul.
That's extraordinary.
A lot of buzz about him, unsurprisingly.
Is there a lot of buzz?
Yeah.
What kind of buzz is there
about? Well, part of it is what country he chooses.
Ah.
So he played for one of the Copenhagen clubs that was then merged to form FC Copenhagen, which is where Laudrup and Niklas Bentner began their careers. So there's some pedigree. Yeah, he's played for England under-16s already. He's eligible for Nigeria, played for Denmark. So you imagine there'll already be a bit of a tug of war going on.
Crikey.
Raheem Sterling, currently the leading cap holder of England players born outside of England. So he's got something to aim at.
Nice. Chido Obi-Martin. Is that how you pronounce it?
I believe so. Okay. Remember the name.
Remember the name. Scotland had a 3-3 draw with Norway.
Yes. I watched the goals from this and quite good fun they were too.
Right.
The highlights of this were more enjoyable than the England ones, I will say.
Yeah. Okay. And anything else that you watched, Daniel?
I mean, I watched England, sadly. My football was domestic-based this season.
Okay.
I watched Romelu Lukaku's first half, which was before going out, which was on Sunday evening, which was the right call.
The perfect.
He stopped just as I was ready for him to start, which is perfect.
Perfect. Very nice. We'll be hearing more about your footballing journeys later on. But next up, we're going to talk about Friday's big news on Merseyside.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Before you get back to this Athletic podcast, did you know it's just one of many made by The Athletic every week? I'm Abby Patterson, senior producer here at The Athletic, and I get to work across so many of our shows. But even I have my favourites. Sometimes you're just too busy for a full-length podcast. I get it. We've all been there. Well, we've got a show to help you. Get up to speed with all the football stories you need to know about with our daily football briefing.
It's done and dusted. Saudi Arabia will host the 2034 World Cup.
Got a bug for the women's game? Then Full-Time Europe is for you. It's our dedicated women's football podcast answering the questions you're asking from the WSL and Champions League.
So what's going wrong at Arsenal?
But perhaps you want to know exactly how a team has set itself up. Then come to the audio whiteboard and join Michael Cox and our analytics gurus as they dissect and examine the game like nobody else can. That's on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
I don't think I've ever seen a striker who reads the game so well.
Just search The Athletic wherever you're listening to this podcast now, and you'll find your next podcast obsession in no time at all. Now, let's get back to your show.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Friday brought a bit of a turn up for Everton. The Toffees hit with a 10-point penalty for breaching the Premier League's profit and sustainability rules in the 2021-22 season. Pending an appeal, it drops Everton from 14th to 19th in the table, only above bottom place Burnley on goal difference. It's the biggest ever penalty handed out in the top flight for comparison. Portsmouth got 9 points. That's the closest we've ever come. And that was for going into administration in 2009-10. But no one's ever got 10 before, not in the top flight. Your reaction?
Well, I was surprised that it was this severe. And I think people who... I know people like Matt Slater, who are very across this kind of world, they were surprised by the severity as well. I think the sense was that it would be, that the Premier League might be talking tough, but when it came to it, they might not go quite this tough.
It does seem that one of the motivations for the severity of it is the fact that it was felt that Everton weren't entirely plain in their dealings with the Premier League.
Yeah, I think that's the big reason why they have. I mean, and I wonder as well, you know, talk of a regulator, and there are other clubs where, you know, that are being looked into, whether they did want to make a big statement. They've certainly done that. I mean, I do feel a bit for Everton when they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, that with those factors that they did want to make this statement and show that they are going to come down tough on clubs. But it does set a really interesting precedent, you know, if other clubs find themselves in hot water, which they already have.
Yeah, well, we'll come on to that in a second or two. But we've just been joined by Matt Jones from the Blue Room Everton podcast. Hello, Matt.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, we're very well. What's the mood among Everton supporters?
A bit of a mix, I think. Initially, when this all came out on Friday, there was a lot of surprise. And I think as it's gone on and kind of manifested and settled with the fan base, I think that's kind of changed towards anger over the weekend for a lot of people. And I can only imagine that's going to build and build up to a crescendo on Sunday when 11 lads in blue walk out to face Manchester United.
Yeah, what a fixture that's going to be. I mean, you could be out of the relegation zone again as early as Sunday if you get the result against Man United, which is far from impossible. And the atmosphere sounds like it's going to be incredible from some of the stuff I'm reading.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as fans, it's the only thing that, you know, a lot of people feel they can really do at the moment. You know, as much as people can reply to the Premier League Twitter account and do all those sorts of things, what we can impact is what happens on the football pitch. And, you know, fan groups over the weekend have already set up GoFundMes for donations in regards to banners and stuff like that. But the last time I checked, that surpassed £30,000, which is obviously going to be channeled in the right way. And I think Everton have got some good fixtures coming up from that sense. They've obviously got United on Sunday. They've got Newcastle and Chelsea to come after that as well. All of them are on broadcast slots as well. So I think there's a great opportunity for fans to send their message of what they feel as though has been a little bit of an overreaction from the Premier League.
All right. Interesting. So, Matt, do you feel that punishment was justified for Everton's business dealings, but just not this magnitude?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of where I've settled at. I think, you know, on Friday, I sort of compared it to, you know, to use a football example, it's the defender leaving the training leg out and the attacker going over it and then saying, well, you kind of gave him the chance to go over there, so you could expect the penalty when maybe it's not quite that. So, yeah, I think Everton have obviously admitted wrongdoing and that has been counted into their appeal. But from Everton's perspective, I think they put forward a number of mitigating factors, only one of which was taken into consideration, and that was that the club are going in the right direction. And listen, they've been working with the Premier League for a couple of years now. They've had every transfer deal and checked over. The Premier League have been looking over every financial decision. They've been over Everton's shoulder from that point of view. So feel like they've been let down a little bit from that perspective, and for the biggest sanction ever in the competition's history to be to be levied at them, I feel, you know, I kind of get where the anger's coming from.
All right. You've got 2/3 of the season to go, and you have picked up 10 points in your last 5 fixtures. So, in a sense, is this actually quite a good season for this to happen in? Say, last year, it might have brought about an entirely different result.
Well, yeah, of course. In the last couple of seasons, I think, you know, this points deduction would have been the final nail in the coffin for Everton from a relegation perspective. But yeah, you know, there's no good time for these things to come, is there? But it does feel like if we're going to try and take positives from it, that this time is ideal. Because I think even if this had been met out at the start of the season and Everton had started on minus 10, that feels like a long way to go. Certainly in terms of not knowing what we know about Burnley, Luton and Sheffield United and how they were going to struggle. And of course, if it had come a bit later on and Everton had maybe just been playing matches to try and stay up and been looking towards that 35-point mark, then it might have been a bit too late. So Everton have shown this season that they're a good side. I think they've shown that they're better than the 3 promoted sides, certainly, and a couple of other teams in this league. And it's not too late either for them to react. So plenty of time for this team to overcome this and potentially push on and like you said, potentially get out of the relegation zone as early as next weekend. But it's going to be interesting, I think, to see if Everton do suffer a setback as well, because I feel like this emotion is either going to be someone that's going to persist, or I can imagine it being really fragile as well. So if Everton were to, say, lose next weekend, drop 5 points behind teams at the relegation zone, does that indignation and anger persist over a tough Christmas period or not?
Right. I mean, anger can be a positive thing, but fear, not so much. At the moment, it seems to be more anger than fear for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, sitting here now, I can only speak for myself, but I don't feel as concerned about being relegated right now as I did at any point towards the end of last season at all. I think Sean Dyche has shown that he can steadily build the team. I think these lads have shown that they've got a lot of spirit. Certainly away from home, the record's become so much better in recent times. So there's reasons to be positive from a purely footballing point of view, and I think the fans will latch onto that. I think the manager's probably ideal for the situation as well. You know, I can almost imagine what he's going to say in every press conference going forward when he's asked about this. He's going to give it a straight bat, which I think is ideal. But I imagine there'll be a bit of spite there as well. And that, I think that's important, because I think Evertonians are ready to go from this point of view. They're ready to seize that emotion. And if it was channeled in the right way, then Everton are going to be absolutely fine.
Yeah. Sounds like Man United have got a bit of a game on their hands on Sunday.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, ominous looking at them seeing the top of the form table in the Premier League. But I think when you actually watch them play, it's a bit of a different story. I know they've got a lot of injuries as well. So obviously there will be better, potentially easier games in the Premier League. But I think it's an ideal one for everyone. I think it's a big enough name that you're excited to go to the game anyway. But with the added context, with the kickoff time being dark under the lights of Goodison Park, it feels like it's going to be a big occasion. And, you know, as soon as that first decision goes against Everton or anything like that, then the place is going to really kick off. And yeah, funny sort of way, can't wait to get in the ground now, even though what's going on this week.
All right, and see the £30,000 worth of banners as well. I'm looking forward to that. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck. I mean, you know, good luck for the season.
Nice one. Pleasure as always.
Matt Jones of The Blue Room, the Everton podcast. Daniel, what's your thoughts on this? We've touched on briefly the fact that there are other clubs. And I think a lot of the reaction to Everton picking up 10 points has been, what about Man City and what about Chelsea?
Yeah, the kind of whataboutery Champions League weekend. It was great. We should say the obvious difference between Everton and Manchester City, and they're the two that have been touted. Everton broke the rules, and effectively their accounts, their filed accounts, admitted that they broke the rules.
Right.
What Manchester City are accused of is systematically cheating to avoid breaking the rules, which is A, far more complicated, and B, there's no, you know, there's no one line, there's no accounts filed that proves that. It's a case of building a case against Manchester City, which the Premier League believe they've done, and they believe that their case is strong enough that Manchester City will be punished for that, but it will take longer because it's more complicated. It's far more complicated. And it's, I suppose, slightly politically more sensitive in that, you know, it's not just we can see you've broke the rules, let's talk about how you've broken, let's talk about why you've broken them, and then let's work on a punishment. It's, yeah, it kind of asks questions of the game itself rather than just a club set of accounts.
Right.
The other thing to say on Everton, by the way, is that we talked about them last season. Leeds, Leicester, Burnley, Southampton, it seems, potentially another couple of clubs trying to get involved as well in suing Everton for loss of earnings because they went down from the Premier League in a season when they believe Everton were breaking the rules and they weren't. That potentially would have very grave consequences for Everton given their financial instability at the moment and the kind of fragile takeover as well.
Those clubs as well can submit evidence during this appeals process to kind of beef up the case against Everton. I imagine if they did, they would make those similar points.
Right. So these charges relate to 21-22 when it was Norwich and Watford and Burnley who went down. But the following season, any benefits from Everton spending would have still been in play, although given the way Everton had been spending, that's a slightly moot point. Any idea on the timescale for Man City and indeed Chelsea, who is it slightly analogous that what's been going on with them in terms of payments coming in that essentially boosted the club's finances but not in a above the board manner, allegedly?
Yeah, we can euphemistically file these as under alleged secret payments in one way or another. Chelsea hasn't quite got the same kind of media impact and public impact, I think partly because they haven't won the league every year, partly because these are slightly more historical and partly because the Chelsea situation seems to be more drip-fed rather than this just big announcement of 115 charges. But yeah, I mean, Chelsea are in a similar boat. It was interesting to hear when those charges were announced, it was interesting to hear the club release a statement saying, well, that was the previous ownership. So, and I thought, well, yeah, but that's not quite the defence you think it is. That might be a personal defence of the owners in charge now, but it's not a defence of Chelsea not avoiding punishment. So, yes, it is going to carry on and on and on and on. I've got no idea when they get settled. I hope that the Everton, effectively the civil case from the other clubs, I hope that is settled by the end of the season. Otherwise, things get very, very messy indeed if they win that case next season, shall we say.
Yeah.
I mean, it is crazy, though, how, even in spite of this, because of their recent good form, like you said, they are one win away from being out of the relegation zone.
Yeah, depending on other results. Are you surprised at the almost unanimous sympathy for Everton over this? To what extent were they cheating and to what extent were they just trying to get through a difficult time?
I mean, that's really hard to say. I think when you get in the, you know, they're saying that they were conceding things and they were presenting money that was coming in as kind of just, you know, nothing interest free and, you know, just
because the loans
balancing the books that way. Yeah, the loans that were coming in basically from their owners.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the sympathy, honestly, is being used as a stick to beat City and Chelsea with. Like, there is sympathy for Everton from a lot of fans, but I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that City in particular, people find it very hard to understand how Everton, for this, are getting such severe sentence, but City with their 115 charges have so far had nothing.
I think the other thing is it feels a little bit, spending a lot of money, too much money, is what clubs do. So that one club should get penalised for it feels almost like harsh for a victimless crime. But when you mention the other teams who have gone down because they did stay within the parameters, and Everton didn't just spend 20 million over, they spent 20 million over the 100 odd million that they were allowed to go over, that's why the Premier League has decided that was unfair, an unfair competitive advantage.
I think the other potential reason for sympathy, and I don't think it's sympathy for Everton as in particular, but I think there is a sense here that the game's quite broken and the game has motivated vast spending. It is instigated it, and it is, yeah, it has kind of welcomed it to a point, and then it said, well, no, actually, that's too much. We want all the best players in our league. We want all the best managers here. We want to have the best league in the world, TM, but actually, that's too much now. Feels a little bit like a kind of fairly random line in the sand. When you look at, for example, the way the Championship is struggling with clubs spending £220 on wages for every £100 they earn, none of this is sustainable. So if this is meant to be about sustainability, I think Everton's point is they would be like, fine, but then can we go and do everyone else now? And can we work out why the game is broken rather than just docking a club 10 points? And as ever, we should say, it's always the fans that feel like they're suffering the most. Mm. It is always them. And there has the punishment can only ever be at the club, because just charging the owners or penalising the owners makes no difference. But it is always the fans that suffer. And the reaction you hear is from fans who are suffering.
Yeah, and it's quite an easy, you know, fans can identify with having owners who've come in and ran the club into the ground and that sort of thing. So I can understand the sympathy there. I think as well, the sympathy because, like you said, it feels in a way laughable because, yes, it did give them, of course, it gave them a competitive advantage. But because they didn't spend the money especially well, I think it's harder in some ways to feel like they've cheated, in inverted commas, whereas City, that's a much easier story to get on board with, isn't it? This club comes in, spends a fortune on amazing players and wins the lot. Yeah, that makes more sense for fans if you're talking about cheating, in inverted commas.
Well, any idea when the appeal might be heard? No idea.
The longer it goes on, the messier it gets, basically. The promoted clubs won't want to hear this, but the best thing that can happen now is that Everton can take 10 points in the next five games as well and move slightly clear and hopefully make...
That's what I mean. It does become less of a story somehow if they are quite comfortable. I mean, I don't know, but a lot of the precedents, certainly in the EFL, from my understand, the points reductions have been reduced on appeal.
Right.
So I do wonder if that might happen again this time, but who knows?
But that gets so messy if Everton are somehow in the relegation zone and then 2 weeks before the end of the season it gets from 10 to 5 points and someone else is pushed into the relegation zone. They then appeal and say, well, Everton should get the full 10, I don't want to go down. It gets so, so complicated.
I mean, we've seen before, like in that 2006-07 season, it's kind of mind-blowing that West Ham stayed up thanks to the goals from Carlos Tevez, and then it was then ruled that they'd broken third-party ownership rules by having him. And obviously Sheffield United are absolutely furious about that because they sued. They did, and they were the club that got relegated. But football is weird in that you just move on. Like historical malpractice, football kind of struggles with, because it's kind of like, well, what's done is done. There's not a lot we can do now.
Mm.
Seems to be the vibe.
Yeah. Should be a cracking game anyway. Sunday, we'll look forward to that. In Thursday's edition of the Totally Football Show. Next up in today's one, though, we're going to have a little look back at what was going on 12 months ago.
Hello, listeners. Danny Kelly here, host of The View from the Lane, your dedicated Spurs podcast from The Athletic. Myself, Charlie Eccleshare, James Moore and Tim Spears are with you twice a week every week this season as we bring you all the news and views you could ever possibly want from in and around the club. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to follow and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of The View from the Lane.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. You're listening to the Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
Big weekend in the WSL and full-time Europe. From The Athletic, we'll be digesting all the top headlines. That's out on Tuesday. Now, today is the 20th of November. 1 year ago today, what was happening? This. That was Ecuador 2, Qatar 0, opening game of that World Cup. Qatar's first ever World Cup match. After years of preparation, they didn't get a single shot on target. Not the only pre-season promise that failed to materialise, if you will, on and off the field. And 12 months on from the weirdest World Cup in history, we're joined now by Adam Crafton to talk about what that tournament actually has meant. Adam, hello.
Hello, you okay?
You're very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
All right. Qatar 2022. It was described as the best ever World Cup at the time by a Mr. G. Infantino, who was a gay female migrant worker, also disabled. 12 months on, what do you think history's verdict is shaping up to be?
I think it's hard to know, isn't it? Because I think the majority of people kind of watch the World Cup or cover the World Cup, and then everyone's kind of forgotten about it, which is how these tournaments tend to work. Now, clearly, it was interesting because the Qatar Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy of the World Cup was called that for a reason, because they made quite a big deal out of the idea there was going to be, if you like, this big legacy. And I think at this moment in time, that whatever that legacy was meant to be, I think is quite unclear on all kinds of grounds, really. You know, if you look at even a very simple thing like the women's team of Qatar had barely played any official games over the past decade. So there doesn't appear to be a legacy in terms of, for example, leveraging the men's tournament in order to grow the women's game in Qatar. You then have Amnesty International released a 1 year on report last week, which was pretty critical of the extent of the reforms, or perhaps more so the implementation of the reforms. And then there was a story we did a few weeks ago, which was talking about how expatriate staff who worked for the Supreme Committee have not been paid bonuses they feel they ought to have been paid for their work on the tournament. This is despite the fact that Qatari nationals essentially doing the same work have received their money. Now, in some ways, you know, you're talking there about strategists, consultants, spin doctors, who, you know, some people would argue basically sold out to a certain extent in order to do that work. And now all of a sudden they have a problem with Qatar. However, you know, it does relate to, I think, staff from dozens of different countries of all different pay grades. So it could be as easily, you know, a receptionist from Nepal as it could be a spin doctor from the United States. So that's just kind of a window into how, I suppose, if when the world turns its eyes away from something, it just becomes a lot harder, I think, for stuff to get done.
You also have a piece out, an interview you did with Lisa Klaveness of the Norwegian FA about some of the promises that were made to make Qatar palatable to the nations going there. And of course, as you say, as the tournament finishes, the promises essentially get forgotten. But where are we on any of the emancipation that this was supposed to enable?
Unclear. I mean, you know, there are still, you know, workers who are being mistreated in Qatar. There's still people who paid huge recruitment fees, you know, particularly, I think, from African countries in order to get to Qatar on the promise of, you know, bigger salaries when they got there. And that side of it wasn't necessarily so much Qatar's fault. You often had, you know, I remember speaking to kind of Kenyan workers out there who had been basically duped by Kenyan recruitment companies. And then they got to Qatar and discovered something very, very different. I mean, one of these guys still sort of sends me messages once a month saying, you know, can you, how do you get out of this country? Right. And that's kind of a window into the desperation to a large extent. It's hard to tell who is really accountable for that, where that accountability falls. FIFA have kind of pledged to look further into what they may be accountable for or responsible for. But again, that's going at snail's pace. It was an interesting conversation with, as you say, Lisa Klaveness, president of the Norwegian FA. And she's actually going out to Qatar in the final week of this month, along with the general secretary of the Danish Federation. They're the only two nations that are going out 1 year on. And they kind of want to see for themselves, you know, what's changed. They're going to speak, I think, to the International Labour Organization when they're there, potentially some of the human rights groups as well, also to workers on the ground, also to the Qatari government, and attempt to come back with some sort of appraisal of where things are at. And I think that kind of reflects the lack of confidence they have in FIFA to do that process. And I think those concerns have only really been amplified by what's happened with the 2030 and 2034 bidding processes, where so much of whatever leverage might FIFA may have been able to hold over whether it is workers' rights, LGBT rights, has essentially been cast aside because the bidding process has essentially been sorted out and inevitable. So, you know, there'll be a vote next year for 2034 in particular, where there's only one bidder. So any leverage that you may have had has kind of gone out of the window, and particularly even more so because you have the president, Gianni Infantino, going on Instagram and declaring that the Saudis are the winners. So good luck trying to get them to do anything that you may want them to do to kind of burnish your image as FIFA over the next decade.
Mm. Adam, you mentioned legacy before. It is one of the biggest legacies of Qatar being awarded the World Cup and then staging it, the exponential rise of Saudis spending an interest in football and the fact that they're going to have the World Cup in 2034.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they offered a demonstration of what's possible, right, in terms of when you're looking to diversify your, because what the two states share in common is this desire to diversify their economy away from oil and gas, because at some point that's going to run out, and therefore it's all about kind of investments in all other sectors so that you have a sustainable, future-proofed economy. So yes, the Qataris, I suppose, showed that sporting opportunities were for sale, and the Saudis have followed that. I think you also have to treat, you know, they are not the same country. Saudi does have this kind of economic and social liberalization program of sorts that is going on. The pace at which that's happening is clearly being contested by human rights groups, you know, particularly in regards to you've sort of seen feminist campaigners who have basically said this isn't happening fast enough. You also have executions still going on. But at the same time, you know, if you speak to people in Saudi Arabia, particularly kind of young people in their kind of 20s or early 30s, they will say that the society they are living in now is radically different to what they grew up with 10, 15 years ago. And they talk about that in a very positive sense. And I think it is positive unless you happen to be critical of the regime, at which point it becomes incredibly authoritarian. It's not as simple as like good v bad, right? This debate. There are grey areas within that. And I think Lisa Klaveness in particular is frustrated is that there was probably an opportunity because of that trajectory for FIFA actually, with if they did a, you know, a kind of a more open, if you like, bidding process, to really leverage the prestige of a World Cup in order to help that society progress further and faster.
Absolutely. Adam, well, listen, thank you very much for giving us that little look back and forward on Middle East and World Cup politics. And look forward to speaking to you soon.
Pleasure. See you soon, guys.
Adam Crafton. Funny thing is, amongst all of this, it was actually a really good World Cup, wasn't it, 12 months ago?
Football-wise, yeah.
Yeah.
Really, really good.
Was that because it wasn't at the end of the season?
It might have been. You know, certainly we have seen World Cups before where it does feel like players are on their last legs, and this World Cup didn't have that feeling. I think also the Argentina story really elevated it. That was something that everyone, apart from maybe kind of Cristiano Ronaldo stands, could get behind. So the quality was really high. I guess you might say then that the second half of the domestic seasons maybe paid for that a little bit.
Oh yeah.
So it depends what your priority is.
Mm. Daniel, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, you asked. You kind of opened the conversation with Adam by asking about the legacy. He touched on it in his last answer, but I think the ultimate legacy of that tournament is that it legitimised to FIFA that they could do what they want. They could ride roughshod over over bidding processes, over their choice to host tournaments. It enabled them to legitimise their model of vast investment in parts of the world that then provide votes for the current president in return. That's not the first time it happened, and it will always happen, but it certainly legitimised it. And yeah, we're left with, because national teams and national publics didn't protest and didn't cause enough of a stink, and they have no obligation to, but they chose not to. That's why we're in Saudi 2034. That's how it's happened, and it will continue to, because these are the countries now who can afford to host these tournaments, I think.
I mean, I know it's different, obviously, cause this is a Euros and it's UEFA, but me personally, I'm so used now to host nations, there being so many controversies and subplots and issues and problems, that the fact that this Euros is happening just in Germany, it feels almost quaint. You know, it's like, oh, a footballing powerhouse, one nation hosting a football tournament. Because even like the last Euros, you know, was spread over lots of different countries. There was a global pandemic, you know.
And the previous World Cup was held in a country that had invaded its neighbour.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, that's how much it's become normalised that it isn't the Germany model. It's all of those things, which is kind of incredible.
Yeah. All right. Daniel, in search of nicer football, should we finish off with a bit of a palate cleanser?
Yeah. Why not? Yeah.
You've been to two places, both of which you can read about on The Eye. One was Exeter City and the other was Sweden. Daniel.
Yes, I started, I was in Copenhagen for Copenhagen versus Manchester United on the Wednesday evening, and I decided that I'd go to Sweden the next day, go across the bridge and do a piece about Swedish fan culture, which is I call it the Rebel Alliance of European football. They are staunchly anti-VAR. All the clubs are fan-owned, so they get a choice. And although the league can bring in measures, they would be stupid to, because the fans realise that they have the power.
So all the clubs in Sweden are fan-owned?
All of them are, like the German 50-plus-1 model, effectively. Yeah. Although a lot less limited companies. It's a lot more kind of ad hoc. But because of that, the people who vote at membership meetings and AGMs are typically the hardcore, and the hardcore don't want VAR, and they don't want their ownership to change, and they don't want the reduction of standing terraces, and they don't want a reduction in ultraculture and pyros. They are incredibly hardcore about it, to the extent that the national team is suffering. Definitely. The quality of the league is suffering, the performance in Europe, and yet they don't care, because they're like, the guys I said, all three of them said, I cannot believe that you have what you have in English culture, in English football, that's so special, and you have allowed states to own your clubs. They're not doing this to be coy or to be kind of controversial. They just cannot fathom why anyone would want that, why they'd want to ruin their matchday experience, why they'd want to ruin what their club stands for. And I hope it continues, because it's an absolute breath of fresh air, to be honest. And then, to kind of semi-complete the circle, I went to go and see Exeter City last week, who are the highest ranked fan-owned club in England, and also the longest period of fan ownership in the Football League. So they have owned it for 20 years, which is less than AFC Wimbledon, but Wimbledon started in lower non-league. And Exeter are this again. They're like we're fighting against. Every time a £2 million striker scores against us, who the club can't really afford but bought anyway, we are bitter because we are sustainable. We have a rainy day fund. We will not spend too much money. We will always be here, and we know we'll always be here. And we're in a climate where nobody else can really say that confidently. Mm.
Did they have a view? But did the subject of Everton come up at all when you were down there?
No, their view is of this independent regulator is of, yes, we need redistribution of funds down. Yes, we need the Premier League to help. But ultimately, and this is a piece I'm going to write this week. I went to Notts County Bradford this weekend, and they had 15,000 there, or 13,000 there, sorry, in the fourth tier. And to my mind, that is English football's greatest cultural asset. It's not the Premier League. It's that we can have 15,000 fans at fourth tier games. And Exeter's point is exactly the same. They're like, that's what needs to be protected here. Let's not focus on, oh, can the Premier League clubs be trusted to self-regulate, or do they need to be taught how to do it? No, fine, get that sorted. But what we need to protect here is a pyramid that allows hundreds and thousands of people to go every weekend to load their local club from one man and his dog to 15,000 in the fourth tier. And if we don't act on that, we will lose it. We'll risk losing it.
Okay. So note of caution, but overall, something to give you a bit of optimism.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah, absolutely. Stood at the end of the back of the stand in Exeter and looked out over the stand that they say, Ollie, we sold Ollie Watkins and we pay for that stand. We sold Matt Grimes and we bought that little cabinet there. And, you know, that to me is, yeah, it's lovely. It is, as you say, a palate cleanser.
Matt Grimes not as valuable then as Ollie Watkins, but he only get a cabinet.
Actually, he was at the time.
It's a nice cabinet.
But then Brentford sold into Aston Villa, and that was their big payout because they had the sell-on. And that literally paid for a £2.9 million stand, which covers half the length of the pitch. So it's so hand-to-mouth, and yet it just fills me with absolute joy.
Okay. Even if you were watching Notts County?
Yeah, I love Notts County, yeah.
Do you?
Yeah,
I've okay, got no. Cool.
Yeah, they're... when they get to within one division of Forest, obviously contractually advised to hate them completely. But until then, I like them.
Very nice. Excellent. Well, that was lovely. Daniel, Charlie, anything you want to leave us with?
Nothing. Nothing as heartwarming as that. No. Right.
Brazil, Argentina, Tuesday night.
That is huge, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, Brazil
haven't won in three
not in a great way. Lost to Colombia.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big
Argentina
one.
Got beaten by Marcelo Bielsa's Uruguay.
Am I right in thinking as well that, well, this the kind of crazy format that South America World Cup qualifying has, that won't be, again, talking about how disrupted football is, that won't be in place, presumably, for the next World Cup, because there'll be automatic qualifiers and that will kind of play havoc with it.
I do admire CONMEBOL qualifying for its ability to always produce pretty much the same teams every World Cup and yet still be really, really exciting. There's a lot to be said. I mean, what's England-Malta? There's a lot to be said.
No, it's true. It does create jeopardy. But yeah, you've got in 2030, Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay are commemorative match hosts.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they have to qualify. I mean, presumably, they'll be there, right?
So then,
So then what does that do for the crazy CONMEBOL qualifying?
The expansion of the whole tournament to 48 teams also changes CONMEBOL because it means that even more teams are going to qualify out of that mad group.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, that's happening, I think, about 12:30 on Tuesday, UK time, late Tuesday. So, why not enjoy that? We'll be back on Thursday with another Totally Football show in which, of course, we'll reflect on some of the international action and also throw forward to an absolutely sizzling round 13 of the Premier League season. For now, many, many thanks to Adam for joining us early. Also, Matt, Charlie, Daniel, producer Charlie, Rachel, you listener. You don't need me to tell you your name. But do join us on Thursday and we'll speak to you then. Ciao.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.